два, три, четыре, раз, два, 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 два. Без новой старшей, без новой старшей. Да, раз, два, три, спокойно, раз, два, три, четыре.
А здесь и есть такой народ, он весело живет. Всегда танцует и поет веселый тот народ. Давно вы не спросите,
на чем Вера?
Какими учат с мамой родина?
Ваша Матвеевича.
This is Odessa's favorite song, sung with the pride of a national anthem by a Jewish children's choir. Odessa, the pearl by the sea, Odessa has seen sorrow, but still it is a lovely, merry city. The words may be banal, but they speak volumes for this quirky city on the Black Sea. Odessa is young, 201 this year. Odessa is defined by the sea, and the sea held a deep fascination for Odessa's greatest literary son, Isaac Babel, as he was growing up in the early years of this century. His stories, spanning the years of the Russian Revolution and Civil War, peer into the many strange corners of this cosmopolitan city, a place of dreams and temptations.
One day I left the house loaded up with case, violin, music, and 12 rubles in cash, payment for a month's tuition. I walked along Nezhinskaya Street. In order to reach Zagorsky's, I should have turned into Dvoryanskaya, but instead I went up Tiraspolskaya and found myself at the port. The time of my lesson flew by in Praktichskaya Harbour. Thus did my liberation begin.
The city's wide avenues and boulevards, where grand 19th century facades hide crumbling courtyards, still entice you towards the sea, and on the way you sense that this is no ordinary East European city. Odessa, says Alexander Shantsor, advisor to the city's mayor, is special.
The Odessans say that our nationality is Odessan. It's a bit of Russia,
и немножко Украины,
a bit of Ukraine,
и немножко Италии,
and a bit of Italy,
и немножко Франции,
and a bit of
и немножко
France,
Израиль,
France,
и немножко Греции,
Greece,
торговым средиземноморским духом.
With a Mediterranean trade air.
So the streets are full of music. Is that common in Odessa?
Yeah, it is. And it's a very jolly place here.
And this street is...
The Deribasovska Street.
And that's the sort of the main shopping street in the center of Odessa.
Yeah, right. Everybody here tries to be very quick. It's one of the things I like of Odessa most of all, that it's a city of energetic, very active people. We're proud of this.
And you never quite know who you might meet.
There'll be the bishop of the oblast of the region. That's him.
This is the bishop, yeah?
Yeah.
Я служитель церкви, епископ церкви.
I'm the bishop of a church.
Церкви по Одесской области, 50 церквей.
Of the 50 churches of the Odessa region.
Да, это чудесный город, я хочу сказать.
It's really a wonderful city, I'd like to say. I worked in many cities, and Odessa may be
отличается веротерпимостью,
by its tolerance,
и каким-то мирным отношением к другим нациям.
And peaceful attitude towards other nations.
Это мне очень нравится.
And I like it very much.
And are you from Odessa?
Я живу в Одессе, да.
Yeah, I live in Odessa.
Моя семья,
and my family.
У меня 9 детей.
I've got 9 children.
И один внук.
And one grandchild.
Music is as close to the heart of Odessa as the sea itself, and the acacia trees which set the city ablaze in early summer. For the last 3 years, the Odessa Philharmonic has had a principal conductor who himself has blown in from overseas, the 35-year-old American Hobart Earl.
There's a certain chemistry, I think, about my relationship with the orchestra, which is very special, because I was born and brought up in South America, and Odessa is a southern city, and the people are very warm, and there was just this tremendous energy in the orchestra, and this tremendous enthusiasm and willingness. I just sort of tried to rise to meet that, and the whole thing just has really blossomed out of that.
Thank you.
Odessa has a very, very special flavor to it. It's a very colorful place. We had a friend of mine from Vienna, the principal trombone of the Vienna Symphony, came here this summer to play a trombone concerto with us. And he had been to another city in Eastern Europe just about 2 weeks beforehand. And he got off the plane, got here, and he was just completely, he said, my goodness, the people are on the street, they're smiling, they're happy, they're wearing interesting clothes, it's bright, it's fresh, and it was completely the opposite from what he'd seen a couple of weeks beforehand, and it was completely the opposite from what he'd expected.
Odessa's literary history is as colorful as its streets. From the very beginning, Odessa was a center for literary innovation, far from the imperial constraints of Moscow and Petersburg. Gogol lived in Odessa, Anna Akhmatova was born here, and by the late 19th century, Odessa was the capital of Russian Jewish literature, in Yiddish, Russian, and Hebrew. Sholom Aleichem, whose tales inspired Fiddler on the Roof, described Sabbath in the Brodsky Synagogue in Pushkin Street with amused irony. There, Odessa's wealthy Jewish merchants would dress up to hear the finest cantors in the Russian Empire, and in their free moments during the week, they would sit and eat ice cream at the gleaming tables of the Café Franconi in Yekaterinskaya Street. Novelists such as Valentin Katayev and Alexander Kuprin, writing in the early years of this century, relished the color and contrasts of Odessa. The gold lettering in every European language at the entrance to the banks and company offices, or the so-called houses of tolerance, where, as Kuprin put it, hideously painted women would call to the sailors in hoarse voices. And back in the 1820s, just a few years after the city had risen from the bare plains of southern Ukraine, Alexander Pushkin spent a colorful year in Odessa after his erotic verses had aroused imperial scorn in Petersburg. Anna Misiuk of Odessa's Literary Museum.
He created the brilliant verses devoting Odessa, and it was the real poetic monument to the city of the period of the beginning of 19th century. He wrote that Odessa is the place where I can find theater, as in Petersburg. I can find clever and aristocratic people, as in Moscow. And I can find all the world in Odessa because of Odessa seaport. It's the gate open to the world.
My home at that time was Odessa the Dusty, whose clear sky prevails where an abundant trades possessor is ever busy hoisting sails. There Europe blows on all the breezes. Life glitters with the south and pleases as shiftingly its hues unfold. The speech of Italy, land of gold, rings in the merry streets, the places where lordly Slavs and Frenchmen walk, where Spaniards and Armenians talk, Moldavians, heaviest of races, and Greeks, and Egypt's sons are there, and Moralee, half-pay corsair.
If these verses by Pushkin are the great literary tribute to 19th century Odessa, it was Isaac Babel who, in his Odessa stories 100 years later, gave the city its second unforgettable literary voice. He was born in 1894 into an Odessa Jewish family. His father was a small trader, and his mother's family had roots going back to the early days of the city. They are part of a Jewish middle class, struggling to keep afloat amid the economic fluctuations of a city built on trade. If his parents had had their way, Babel's career would have followed a rather different course.
Now we're in Tiraporskaya Street, in the center of Odessa, another 19th century tree-lined street, at number 13. And this is the house Babel's family came back to in 1905, when he was 11, because when he was 2, they left Odessa for the nearby port of Nikolaev. And then later they came back and they lived in this house in the center of the town. And this was the time when his family decided that they wanted him to become a great violinist. Babil was sent to learn the violin under the same teacher as the greatest of all Odessa violin prodigies, David Oistrakh.
All the people of our circle, brokers, shopkeepers, bank and steamship office employees, taught their children music. Our fathers, seeing no chance of success for themselves, devised a lottery. They established it on the bones of little children. Odessa was seized by this madness worse than other towns. For decades, our town put Wunderkinder on the concert platforms of the world. From Odessa came Misha Elman, Zimbalist, Gabrilovich, Yasha Heifetz began among us. When a boy was 4 or 5, his mother took the tiny, puny creature to Mr. Zagorski. Zagorski ran a Wunderkind factory, a factory of Jewish dwarfs in lace collars and patent leather shoes. He sought them out in the slums of the Moldavanka, in the evil-smelling courtyards of the old market. Zagorski gave them a first push in the right direction, and then the children were sent to Professor Auer in St. Petersburg. In the souls of these starvelings with blue, swollen heads dwelt the mighty power of harmony. They became renowned virtuosi. And so my father decided to hold his own with Heifetz and Misha Elman. Though I had passed Wunderkind age, I was in my 14th year, my short stature and puny physique made it possible for me to be mistaken for an 8-year-old. In this lay all their hopes.
You can go all over the world and you will find professional musicians who were from Odessa. There are former members of the Odessa Philharmonic Orchestra, in the Philadelphia Orchestra, in the Baltimore Symphony, in the Toronto Symphony, also in the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. But I think the city needs music today more than ever. And I'll tell you why, because the city is really associated with music. People know that Oistrakh was born here. People know that Milstein was born here. And therefore, music is one of the best things that the city can use to promote its well-being with.
This is part of Edmund Meisel's score to Sergei Eisenstein's film Battleship Potemkin. For some time, Eisenstein lived and worked in Odessa. The film's scene of a motherless baby plummeting in its pram down the Potemkin steps has provided the city's most enduring and unnerving image. The steps, the Escalier Monstres as they were known in the 19th century, were renamed in honor of the 1905 Potemkin mutiny, immortalized in the film. A trick of perspective, the steps are wider at the top than the bottom, exaggerates the grand sweep between the port and Odessa's most elegant 19th century street, the Primorsky Boulevard. Here, smart young Odessans still stroll on summer evenings, in the shade of a double row of plane trees and beneath the Art Nouveau excess of the Hotel Londonskaya. In the midst of all this, at the very top of the steps, stands Odessa's first city chief, the Duc de Richelieu, just over life size and dressed as a Roman citizen. His right hand is outstretched, perhaps to show Odessa's openness to the world, or more likely is pointing to the source of the city's wealth, the port. As a Frenchman, an aristocrat who had served in the Russian Imperial Army, the Duke began Odessa's long international tradition, and his vision of the city combined enlightened despotism with a very modern awareness.
The Duc de Richelieu were the men of future, were the men of new 19th century. He found two meanings which can integrate this different nations, different language and peoples from different social levels too. Art and humor. Richelieu understood that humor is the best meaning for understanding each other. It was the beginning of long traditions of Odessa's humor, a famous Odessa's humor.
So Odessa developed as a motley mixture of local color and cosmopolitan sophistication. Isaac Babel's early stories from the days before the Russian Revolution are steeped in Odessa Jewish tradition, looked upon from the ironic, humorous angle of the cosmopolitan city.
Of 6 Fridays, Herschelet celebrated one. On the other evenings, he and his family sat in darkness and cold. The children cried. His wife hurled reproaches. Each one of these reproaches was as heavy as a cobblestone. Herschelet would reply in verse. One day, we are told of such an incident. Herschelet wanted to be provident. On a Wednesday, he set off for the fair in order to make some money for the Friday. All listened to Herschelet's jokes, but there was no one at home when it came to the reckoning. His stomach as empty as a wind instrument, Herschelet trudged home. "What have you earned?" his wife asked him. "I have earned a life beyond the grave," he replied. "Both rich man and poor man promised me it." Herschelet's wife had only 10 fingers. She bent each one of them in turn. Her voice rumbled like thunder in the mountains. "For every wife, her husband is a man. Only mine thinks he can feed a wife on words. God grant that by New Year he should lose his tongue, his hands, and his feet." "Amen," replied Herschelet.
The communist regime didn't know what to make of all this, and did all it could to stifle cosmopolitan Odessa. It was still more suspicious of a city where up to a third of the population was Jewish. But as long as the sea remained, here in Odessa, a little of the world outside always managed to seep through the Iron Curtain. And still today, Odessa is a peculiar cocktail.
Ob mir anigendil mit naches und mit broch, mit naches und mit broch, singen mir es beides mir es, das Gott noch gesungen die ganze Mischproche, wenn sie seinen Kinder...
Anya Schatz is a young member of Odessa's Jewish community, which despite mass emigration still amounts to tens of thousands. Despite the temptation to leave for America or Israel, she's determined not to forget her identity as a European, Odessan Jew.
I
was born in a family which was rather far from the Jewish traditions.
When
I grew up, I just became interested in what was written in my passport. So, you know, the nationality is mentioned in the passport. The Holocaust maybe influenced me most of all, and it was a kind of push for me, and I started to be interested in the Jewish culture.
And you're actually studying Yiddish?
Yeah, I started Yiddish. Now I'm just in связи со своими определенными.
Yeah, I started to study Yiddish.
Ну, скажем так, вот эту вот искру культуры. Это я даже не назову культурой, потому что до этого мне далековато.
If I keep this culture inside and if I pass it to somebody,
эту искру культуры я передам еще кому-то, значит, она проживет и не затухнет еще какое-то время.
Then it will be alive for some time. If in the future generation there is somebody who will be able to continue it, then probably there will be some generation,
которая увидит, как это было замечательно. Давайте к этому вернемся.
How fine it was, how beautiful it was, and will say, let's go back to it.
At the time of the Russian Revolution in 1917, Isaac Babel was a young man of 23. He embraced the new world, and during the Civil War, he joined the Cossack Regiment of the Red Cavalry as a journalist. Babel was fascinated by the energy and brute strength of the Cossack troops, their sheer force compared with his own asthmatic, bespectacled frame. But during the cavalry's campaigns through Poland, he also saw an ancient Jewish world, the world of his ancestors, that was rapidly being shattered.
At the 12th mile, when I had run out of potatoes, I chucked a pile of Trotsky's leaflets at them, but only one of them stretched out a dirty, dead hand for a leaflet, and I recognized Ilya, the son of the Zhytomyr rabbi. I recognized him immediately, Vasily, and so painful was it to see a prince who had lost his trousers, broken in two by a soldier's knapsack, that, breaking the regulations, I hauled him into our carriage. His bare knees, as clumsy as an old woman's, bumped against the rusty iron of the steps. Two plump-breasted girl typists in sailors' jackets dragged the long, shy body of the dying man along the floor. We put him down in a corner of the editorial office on the floor. Cossacks in wide red oriental trousers adjusted his fallen clothes. The girls coldly observed his sexual parts, the wilted, curly virility of a Semite worn to a shadow. While I, who had seen him on one of my nights of stray wandering, began to pack the scattered belongings of the Red Army soldier Bratslavsky into a trunk. He died before we got to Rovno. He died, the last prince, among poems, phylacteries, and foot bindings. We buried him at a forgotten station, and I, who am barely able to accommodate the storms of my imagination within my ancient body, I received my brother's last breath.
In his Red Cavalry stories, Babel writes with a strange, passionate detachment, observing but passing judgment on no one.
His view, it's view of deep understanding. He understood this old rabbis and he understood these Cossacks. He understood two sides. And his stories now full of energy of this understanding. It was the age of deep crisis of mentality, of forms of life. And his style, this style of crisis.
The order that came out of this crisis was imposed by Stalin. It was the beginning of a brutal process that with a sickening predictability was one day to kill Babel. But Babel's Odessa proved resilient.
И был голод в той земле, и сошел Авраам в Египет пожить там, потому что усилился голод в той земле.
Every Friday, a group of Jewish intellectuals meets in a cramped apartment to read and discuss the Torah and to discuss their position in today's Odessa, something that only a few years ago could have led to imprisonment.
I do think that all the nationalities which make this whole picture are very important, and if one of them is missing, then the picture is not complete.
It's true, yes.
Для ситуации одесской особенно, да.
Special for Odessa. The special situation in Odessa, because Odessa is the mix, the culture, different culture.
I think that cosmopolitan life is under threat and that people are losing their cultural identity in a way, because people whom they used to speak to just aren't there anymore. And it's very difficult to keep this sort of contact just by writing letters. Or
what you're talking about is emigration, in fact.
Yes. Yes, and you can see this goes on very quickly.
Most people are not so pessimistic, but the reasons for Odessa's cultural crisis today are not hard to find.
So here I am in one of Odessa's main banks in Pushkin Street to change some dollars. I've got $100 here, which I've just changed for 14 million Ukrainian coupons. The rate of inflation is absolutely phenomenal here. And so I've just been given a great wad of currency. And in the background, we can hear the machines which actually do all the counting, and they hand over piles of this money, which really doesn't look like it's real money at all. It looks like something out of a Monopoly game. But the bank itself is in a wonderful building, late 19th century, rather grand, next door to the synagogue in Pushkin Street and opposite the former stock exchange, which is now the center for the Odessa Philharmonic Orchestra.
It's maybe sometimes not so easy for us to keep our enthusiasm going as high, because I have to be honest, things have really gotten a lot worse in the last 4 years. And that if you analyze the musicians' lives then, the amount of money they earned then was enough to survive on. Today, it's not at all. Even though their musical lives might be much better or much more interesting now than they were 4 years ago, their financial lives and their personal lives from just the logistical point of view are much more complicated. The orchestra is probably better off though than the average person in Odessa or in Ukraine, because they do receive a higher government wage than the norm is. And of course, thank goodness, they are able to add to this government wage with hard currency whenever we go abroad, which is about twice a year.
This is your office. It's modern, it's up to date. Obviously, there's been a lot of changes under your leadership.
Well, I love the way you say it's up to date. That is only the case until you pick up the telephone and try to make a phone call or try to send a fax, and then you suddenly realize that you are in a country which is not necessarily so easy to get things done in. But actually, yes, we have sort of something which looks like an office, and that certainly is a lot more than we had when I came. I have to tell you, it's true, the bookkeeper of the Odessa Philharmonic Society had never seen a photocopy machine in her life. And I watched her eyes when she saw, about 2 years ago, we got a tiny little photocopy machine there, or eyes was the paper went through and came out with a copy on it. I mean, it was just the expression on her face was just one of complete and utter amazement. They used to do their bookkeeping using an abacus. Even 4 years ago, when I arrived here, they didn't have access to pocket calculators. Very skillful at using the abacus, I have to say, and in using it very well. But of course, now we have pocket calculators, we have computers, we have faxes, we have high tech of that sort.
Well, one thing that surprises me just standing here is the number of big Western cars. Where does the money come from?
Well, nobody knows, but actually, the average price of such a car here would be $50,000-$60,000. People get $20 per month. I mean, just usual salary, average salary. So nobody knows, but still there are many rich people.
Where do you think the money comes from?
Well, maybe from the West. The people who drive such cars usually are involved in some businesses, joint ventures. So, but usually they never tell. It's a visual part of the unseen world.
In fact, you don't have to go far in Odessa to get a taste of this unseen world. When she isn't learning Yiddish, Anya Schatz earns her daily bread gathering economic information for the local television station. Her main source of information, strangely enough, is a Gretchenskaya Square book market, just off Deribasovskaya Street.
Вот. На сегодняшний день здесь редко кто торгует только книгами. Большинство людей.
People who sell only books are very few here.
Большинство людей все-таки торгуют валютой.
The majority sells both books and currency.
Или же только валютой.
Or maybe only currency.
Вот. Это основное место обмена валюты.
This is the main place of changing currency. A kind of currency stock exchange.
I noticed that while we've been standing here, a couple of policemen went in and they shook hands with some of the people changing the money. So obviously this is tolerated by the authorities.
Власти не просто терпимо относятся, то есть власти должны относиться терпимо, а вообще.
They not only tolerated, though they have to be tolerant towards this market.
Власти должны приветствовать, разрешить, помогать и поддерживать.
They have to be in favor of this market and to help them.
Всегда, 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 всегда.
You can always, 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 always come here. It's something close, rather close to the London Exchange, Stock Exchange.
In the Odessa of Babel's stories, Benya Krik rules supreme as king of the city's underworld. His kingdom is the infamous district of Moldavanka. He's modeled on a real historical figure who in 1920s Odessa went by the exotic name of Mishka the Japanese, part Robin Hood, part gangster, and typically Odessan.
At this moment, the young man who had arrived at the beginning of the evening appeared in the courtyard.
King, he said, I must have a word with you.
Go on then, Benya Krik, the king of the gangsters asserted. You always have a word or two in stock.
King, said the unknown young man, giggling, this is plain ridiculous. The police station is burning like a candle.
The delicatessen owners were struck dumb. The gangsters smirked.
About 40 of them came out of the police station. They were coming on a raid, but when they had gone about 15 paces, the place caught fire.
Benya forbade his guests to go and watch the fire. He set off with two companions. The police station was meticulously ablaze on all four sides. Policemen, their backsides ajog, were running up and down the smoke-filled stairways, throwing boxes out of the windows. On the quiet, the prisoners were making themselves scarce. The firemen were full of zeal, but it turned out that there was no water in the nearby hydrant. The superintendent, the new broom, stood on the opposite pavement, biting his moustache. Without movement, the new broom continued to stand. Benya, as he walked past the superintendent, gave him a military salute.
Good health, Your Excellency, he said sympathetically. What can one say of this misfortune? Why, it's a nightmare.
He fixed his eyes dully on the burning building, shook his head and smacked his lips.
Ay, ay, ay.
In Moldavanka today, there are still some people who remember that time. Valentina Ivanovna is 91.
The gang Babel wrote about was very famous in Moldavanka. And
I should admit that they were not hiding, they were acting rather openly. In the center of the city, you could see a policeman on every block, but there they were few.
Do you think that they were afraid to go there?
Наверное, они боялись туда просто ходить.
Только центр, городские улицы.
Generally speaking, police protected people, but not in Moldovanka.
Moldovanka was a working-class suburb, mainly Jewish, but by no means exclusively, and certainly not a ghetto. Moldovankans were poor. Some worked as tailors, adapting old clothes. Some were jewelers, altering much-worn wedding rings. Many were bookbinders, repairing battered family Bibles. Young girls worked in Odessa's button factories. And of course, there were the dockers down at the port. But the most characteristic group in Moldovanka's population were the bindushniki, cart drivers, notoriously tough characters renowned for their fearlessness. They had their own dances, which involved a lot of stamping and yelling, and their own peculiar laws of behavior, honesty, and friendship. Benya Krik's father is a bindushnik, a tough man even amongst these toughest of men. He's known in Moldovanka as Mendel the Pogrom. Alexander Rosenboim is an Odessa historian with a special love of Moldovanka.
Every house had a big yard.
Во дворе проходила большая часть жизни, особенно летом.
And the main part of life was going on in those yards.
Здесь, например, справлялись свадьбы, торжества. Вот убавили в рассказе, что во дворе была
свадьба.
For instance,
weddings were celebrated here. Well, and it's well described in Bible stories. And they were washing clothes also in those yards. As far as kitchens were rather small. And in summer, when it was very hot, they even took out beds and slept in the yards.
Старожилы вспоминают, что здесь жили люди разных национальностей.
And they say that people of many nationalities lived here. Nobody was interested in nationality, in your nationality.
Каждый молился своему Богу.
That is, everybody prayed to their own God, but everybody lived together.
Помогали друг другу.
And helped each other.
Now we're inside the courtyard of this old Moldovanka building. The building goes all around the courtyard, and the houses have little wooden staircases and balconies, all of wood. It's rather crumbling, very shabby, and there's smoke coming out of the chimneys. And it probably looks very much as it did in Babil's time.
The wedding ceremony was at an end. The rabbi wearily lowered himself into an armchair. Then he went out of the room and saw tables placed the whole length of the courtyard. There were so many of them that they thrust their tail out of the front gate into Hospital Street. The velvet-covered tables coiled about the yard like snakes that had had patches of every colour applied to their bellies, and they sang in thick voices, these patches of orange and red velvet. The apartments had been turned into kitchens. Through soot-grimed doorways beat a corpulent flame, a drunken and pudgy flame. In its smoky rays, baked old women's faces, bumpy female chins, well-thumbed breasts. Sweat, as pink as blood, as pink as the foam of a rabid dog, flowed round these heaps of burgeoning, sweetly stinking human flesh. Three cooks, not counting the dishwashers, were preparing the wedding supper. Over them reigned the 80-year-old Razel, as traditional as a scroll of the Torah, tiny and hunchbacked.
Moldova, Moldova.
Many songs celebrate Moldovanka. Babel's family had lived in Moldovanka during his earliest childhood, and when he came back from the Civil War in the early 1920s, it was to Moldovanka that he chose to return. But he must have been a pretty unlikely figure there. As his friend and contemporary, the writer Konstantin Paustovsky wrote, he looked more like a travelling salesman or a broker than a writer, and still less like the people in whose midst he was living. He had a stoop, almost no neck, and terrible asthma. But, says Paustovsky, when he opened his mouth, everything changed. Through the thin timbre of his voice, you could sense his resolute irony. Many people, writes Paustovsky, could not look into Babel's burning eyes, for it was in his nature to see through to the truth. Babel wanted to capture the world of Moldovanka before it was lost forever. The stories of the Moldavanka gangsters create a myth of Odessa, a myth which may be far from historical accuracy, but for many captures the essence of Odessa. Alexei Shevchenko, student and interpreter, is in love with this myth.
He's a part of the world which used to exist some years ago, and, well, I don't know, but I can speak for myself. For me, it's a very romantic world, and to my mind, many people just would like this world to come back, just to enjoy the atmosphere it used to have.
But you say his world's cozy, but it's also a world of murders, of corruption, of gangsters, if you read the Odessa stories.
Yeah, that's right, but you don't really perceive them like something very cruel, and there is so much romance in them.
Babel was not only celebrating Moldavanka, he was also recording its decline. One of his Odessa stories catches the brutality of this change and foretells his own later fate and the fate of hundreds of thousands of Soviet citizens in the purges. The story, set in 1919, just 2 years after the October Revolution, tells of the murder of the old Moldavanka gangster, Froim Gruch. Some of his men are arrested by the Cheka, the forerunners of the KGB. He goes of his own accord and unarmed to the police station in Yekaterinskaya Square, just behind the Potyomkin steps, to plea for his men's release. He's given a glass of cognac and then shot in the yard, with no charge brought against him and no trial. The Moscow Chekists, under their youthful leader, Simen, kill Gruch without consulting Borovoy, the local police chief.
Borovoy, as he sat in his corner, listened. He sat alone, far away from the others. Simen came over to him after the meeting and took him by the hand. "You're angry with me, I know," he said. "But the fact is, we are the authorities, Sasha. We are the state power. You have to remember that." "I'm not angry," Borovoy replied, turning away. "You're not from Odessa. You can't understand it. There is a whole story around this old man." They sat down side by side, the head of the Cheka, who was 23 years old, and his subordinate. Simon held Borovoy's hand in his and pressed it. "Answer me as a Chekist," he said, after a silence. "Answer me as a revolutionary. Why is this man needed in the society of the future?" "I don't know." Borovoy did not move and looked straight in front of him. "I suppose he isn't." He made an effort to drive the memories away from him. Then, growing animated, he again began to tell the Chekists who had come from Moscow about the life of Froim Gruch, about his resourcefulness, his elusiveness, his contempt for those near to him, all those amazing stories that had retreated into the past.
With the end of old Odessa, Babel lost his literary voice. The paradoxes and life energy of the city had been the food for his creation. In 1924, he left Odessa for Moscow, but published little after his Odessa stories. In a speech to the Writers' Congress in 1934, Babel spoke self-deprecatingly of himself as practicing a new literary genre, the genre of silence. He could have emigrated, but chose to stay. He was fascinated by Moscow as the seat of power and never gave up his search for a language in which to portray this world. He mixed with party officials and police chiefs at the heart of Soviet power, including the infamous police chief Yezhov, and even more dangerously, Yezhov's wife. His flirtation with this world was as dangerous as the battlefields of Poland he had seen with the Red Cavalry.
3 times in his biography, he put his nose to the most dangerous place for him. At first, he put his nose to the Red Army cavalry, to the Cossacks, and he wrote a brilliant stories about them, about their history. And in the second time, he put his nose to the bandit's nest, to Odessa's Moldavanka, and he described their life. And he created the image of last days of Odessa's famous gangsters. But in this third time, he put his nose to the apartment of Commissar of State Security, Nikolai Yezhov. And this third time that brought him the death. The death. The third. But I think that Isaac Babel, he could not live without danger, because only danger gave him this full understanding of existing.
Babel was arrested on the 16th of May 1939 at his dacha near Moscow. For over 50 years, his fate remained a mystery. It was assumed that he was shot or died in a labor camp sometime between 1939 and 1941. Only now has the full story emerged with the opening of secret KGB files.
You have been detained for treasonable anti-Soviet activities. Do you acknowledge your guilt?
No, I am not guilty.
But how can you reconcile this protestation of innocence with the fact of your arrest?
I consider that my detention is the result of a fatal set of coincidences and of my creative impotence, which has prevented me from publishing any significant work for the last few years. This, in the Soviet view, could be taken as deliberate sabotage and a refusal to write.
Don't you think that explanation is disingenuous?
You're right, of course. Writers don't get arrested for inactivity.
Defendant Babel, do you have anything to add to your statement?
I can't add anything to my statement. But I request that you take note of the fact that I have committed a serious offence.
What offence?
I have slandered certain people and have made false declarations about some of my supposed terrorist activities. I lied out of cowardice.
Babel's glasses and his pen were presented to our museum by Antonina Piroshkova, Babel's widow. And she said, and I saw that his glasses lie on the table. And I understood in the same minute that they will kill him, because he could not live without glasses any day. He had very bad eyesight, and he needed glasses every minute.
Isaac Babel was tried and found guilty, having seen to the heart of darkness of Stalin's power. The sentence was carried out on the 27th of January, 1940, the KGB files state bluntly. But 55 years after his death, for many in Odessa, Babel's spirit is alive and well.
You can feel it everywhere. Just in every company, in the streets, everywhere. It's a whole mixture of many, many things, of a wisdom of life, of humor, of friendly way of treating other people, of tolerance. These are probably the basic components.
It's very hard to predict where things are going to go. These are difficult times. Far more difficult than most of us in the West really have any idea. But I do think that Odessans are very creative people, and they're very good at solving their own problems. Your typical Odessite is very quick on his feet and very flexible and very, very sharp and able to improvise. And that's a very important thing when you have to survive. So I think the city will survive, and I certainly hope it does.
Odessa is an awful place. Everyone knows how they murder the Russian language there. All the same, I think there's a lot to be said for this great city, which has more charm than any other in the Russian Empire.